with me, Lucy Parsons. Welcome to this amazing episode we've got today with Lisa Cherry, who is a trauma expert who works in education. More about that in a minute. I wanted to do this episode as we head back to school after the COVID lockdown and after the trauma of A-level and GCSE results, because I think it's really important that we become emotionally aware of what young people have been going through, what adults have been going through as well, and not just within our own families, but being aware of it for other students. So I think this is a really important message as we head back to school. So welcome to the School Success Formula, Lisa Cherry.
Thank you, Lucy. It's very lovely to be here.
Okay, Lisa, before we dive in, could you tell people what you do and how you came to be doing it?
Right, well, that's like a really big question. And I guess that's the way it is for lots of people of my age as well, is that, you know, we've had this number of years to arrive somewhere. But what I do basically now is I work across all the sectors. I do a lot of work in education, in the education sector, supporting teachers and schools to have a deeper understanding around attachment, adversity, and trauma, and the impact on their students, so that when the students then have behaviours that may be found to be challenging, there is a better understanding as to where those behaviours are coming from, and an understanding that those behaviours are communicating something that we need to have a look at. How I got there was I spent 10 years working in social work and 10 years working predominantly with young people in care and leaving care. And then I spent 10 years working in education, again, working predominantly with students who were not attending school or were at risk of school exclusion. And then the last 10 years, as I said, I've been training and speaking, focusing really on, you know, that whole area of deepening people's understanding, so that the trajectories that are sometimes associated with behavior that we might find difficult to understand are something that we can avoid. So, for example, reducing school exclusions would be something I would be very passionate about.
Amazing. Okay, just so that everybody understands, I think most people listening will have heard the words before, but you mentioned attachment and adversity. Can you just clarify exactly what you mean by that before we move on?
Yeah, so when we're thinking about children who experienced difficult beginnings in their early attachment relationships, we might be thinking about children who have been adopted. We might be thinking about children who are in care. And by that, I mean in foster care or in residential care. So they're looked after away from home. In terms of adversity, we might be thinking about children living around, now this is a really complicated area, all this, so I'm trying to put this in a nutshell, but just for your audience to have a sort of a more rounded idea. So in terms of adversity, we might be thinking about a bereavement, we might be thinking about poverty, we might be thinking about physical abuse, neglect, sexual abuse, a whole range of things. And we might be thinking about children who experience a number of adversities, but also we might be thinking about children who experience those adversities outside of the context of those more stable attachment bases. When we're thinking about trauma, trauma is what we would use to refer to something that has overwhelmed the system.
The body and mind
has overwhelmed the system, and nobody has come along to soothe that is about the simplest way that I can think about childhood, perhaps potentially moving into thinking about developmental trauma. And I must add at this stage, I've just literally writing a book, and the first chapter of each section, one is on attachment, one is on adversity, and one is on trauma. And I cannot tell you how difficult it is to explain those areas, even in 2,500 to 3,000 well-referenced words, let alone in a podcast. So forgive me if I haven't expressed it well, but I hope well enough to give your audience an idea about the kind of things that I'm working with.
Yeah, so just to summarise, so attachment is basically that relationship that a normal parent and child would develop within weeks and months of birth. And it's that safe relationship where children can kick off and be naughty and they'll be forgiven and loved and all that kind of thing. And correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I'm never good with the word normal, I have to say, but no. That aside, you've kind of got the gist of it. It's that relational dance where I ask for attachment and you give attachment. And I ask for that in a range of ways from a very, very early part of my life. Mm-hmm. And you meet that often without even realizing that you're meeting it in that lovely dance that you have, that attachment dance.
And adversity is difficult things that happen in your life, and trauma is when those difficult things are kind of unresolved for you, so it's kind of lingering stress.
I think in terms of putting all of that into one sentence each, you've done amazingly.
Thank you. Okay, so the reason that I've kind of got you here today is because we're heading into a new phase from the lockdown and school closures as students return to schools. And I think everybody would agree that it's been a stressful time. And what I wanted to talk with you about is what kinds of trauma students will have experienced over the last few weeks of lockdown. So that might be trauma, it might just be stress. I know whether we can distinguish the two, but there'll be, and I think those things will be on a spectrum, won't they, on a continuum. So I think everybody will have experienced something, but some will have, you know, we've heard in the news about the worries that people have about vulnerable children and that kind of thing. So there's a really wide spectrum there. So can you start by talking about, I think I should frame this as well by saying, you know, I've had quite a few issues with kind of health and all that kind of thing. And people kept saying to me, well, have you experienced trauma? And I was like, no, I've had the easiest life you could possibly think of. You know, I've everything's kind of gone to plan in my life. And, you know, I couldn't ever claim that I had experienced trauma when, you know, there are people who've been bereaved and people who've been abused or neglected. And, you know, I don't have those experiences. But it came out talking to various people that actually, I have experienced trauma. Like, for example, I've had two emergency cesarean sections, the first of which in particular I found very difficult to get my head around and didn't kind of get any help kind of resolving that mentally for myself. So I'm just putting that into context because I think some people will think it's been stressful, but it hasn't been trauma. So I want to hand that over to you, Lisa, with that kind of caveat, so people understand how the word trauma might actually apply within their life situation this year. Does that make sense?
It really does. And thank you for contextualizing that for people, because I think there is often a view that trauma is something that somebody did to you on purpose to harm you. And this is where it becomes incredibly complicated, because we might think about Sorry, a butterfly or a moth has just come right inside my room, distracting me, as I am so often distracted. That would have got me a detention, I think, that sort of distraction. Which might be, you're talking about birth trauma, which overwhelmed your system. And if you were not able to be supported through that, which you're saying you weren't, then that's going to have overwhelmed you. The difference, I guess, is that what you have to your in your kind of bag is that you described having had a life that you hadn't experienced all of those things. So already what you have is you have this big pool upon which to draw of resilience, yeah, that comes out of the safety and security of the relationships that you've had. So we might, if that had happened to somebody that had not had all of that, then we start to really see that spectrum of trauma. Where, okay. Does that make sense?
So it makes complete sense. So basically, if you experience trauma, it's much easier to cope with it if you've got the resilience that is given to you by a lack of adversity and secure attachment.
And that resilience is relationship-based. This is the other thing that people get very confused about when they think about resilience. They see it as this individual character trait, particularly in reference to children and young people. But we hear it around adults as well, which is they're just not trying hard enough. If, you know, they need to build their resilience and, you know, build their mindset and all of those kind of ideas. But actually, our resilience is very much built upon the relationships that we've had available to us and that we continue to have available to us to support us.
Okay, so should we put this in the context of what has happened this year? So in terms of the trauma or stress that people have experienced, I mean, most of my listeners are going to come from quite secure homes. So I think it'd be useful to talk about that in their context, but then how that might look different for people who come from a different kind of background. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to unpick there. So what I would say is that this experience has been so diverse for so many different people. And there are lots of people who don't have experience of overcoming adversity who will have had a very adverse experience during this time. They may well be experiencing redundancy. Mm-hmm. They may well be experiencing concerns around finances. Mm-hmm. So the children may well be in an environment where they're starting to hear about money concerns. Living with uncertainty alone is really, you have to have quite a big window of tolerance to sort of manage the daily not knowing what's happening next.
And so, I think everybody has that at the moment, don't they? Because, you know, none of us know what's happening with this virus, do we? And, you know, most days I kind of think, I just wish I knew what was going to happen. Like somebody could tell me what the trajectory was. But you know, so that is the kind of the uncertainty that we are all dealing with, isn't it?
Yeah. And the only difference will be each person's capacity to hold that sense of unknowing and uncertainty. And of course, if we have any Buddhists listening, this is nothing to them because they know that there's nothing certain anyway. So their window of tolerance around that is going to be exponential. But for people who really like to know what's going on, or for whom constant change has always happened from external sources and they haven't recovered from that, that might feel very difficult. It might be if you're used to moving around or you're used to having uncertainty and you've adapted to that and recovered from that, that you're going to find this experience fine. Your window of tolerance is going to be quite large. So I think what we're really looking at is how do we exercise the empathy muscle to deepen our compassion towards diverse experiences, because some of the children in the classroom are going to have had a lovely time. They're going to have had more of their parents. They're going to have had stability. They might be even, aside from your secure parents, they might be children who, for whom school is a horrendous experience. Yeah. And they've been at home and built relationships with their foster carers. So they've had more outdoor time, more exercise time, more adult time, less stressful time, right the way to the other end of the spectrum, where some children lost their safe place overnight and do not have a safe place anywhere else other than at school. They may also be in environments where they did not know when the next meal was coming. They may also have been around a lot of domestic violence. They may also have been in environments where their foster placement broke down, so they had to go into another, or their adoptive placement broke down, so they've been taken back into care. There's a whole range of experiences that the classroom is somehow, which it ordinarily has to hold anyway. That's what education is. It's education for all. But what the pandemic has done, as it has highlighted the inequities, the inequalities that are expansive in the country that we live in.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it's a tragedy on so many different levels that this has happened. So if parents are listening to this and looking at their children, what like signs might there be that there is unresolved trauma from this experience of the school closures and the pandemic for their children?
Yeah, or that it has been really adverse for them. And I think some young people, one of the things I felt really strongly about was that young people were not spoken about at all other than in the context of exam grades.
Yes.
I did not hear any conversation about young people. Now, we know that young people really need their young people. You know, they operate in packs. You don't see teenagers wandering about alone. That's just not how they operate. So the loss of those forming friendships that help young people not be their parents, but actually become independent people, were taken away during lockdown. So that could be a particularly adverse experience to come out the other side of. Certainly issues around safety and fears about making people poorly is something that I've heard from young people. An anxiety that they're going to be carrying this and they're going to be okay, but they're going to somehow unknowingly kill their family. I mean, imagine that whirring around your head while at the same time having Instagram and Facebook showing you, you know, the highlights of people's highlights, or, you know, the lowlights of the lowlights, you know, this constant media stream and connection. When we're looking at behavior that we might find challenging, and let's face it, that tends to be when we notice something's not right, which means that those children, young people who go under the radar are the most concerning, because we're much more likely to respond to those children and young people that are in our faces, making life feel very uncomfortable. So I need to just throw that in there. But the kind of things that we might see that tell us that something isn't right, or that extra support needs to be put in, might be isolating themselves, might be, and this is going to be different for everybody, might be very angry outbursts. And if we think about that in a kind of language context, trying to express what's going on is very difficult for the most articulate of us. So expressing what's going on when you don't have the vocabulary to do so is going to mean that you see much more in the way of action, if you like. It's not, you know, unless you have a child who's going to be able to say to you, when you're free, could we have a cup of coffee so that we can kind of sit down and just talk through what's been going on during COVID? I'm not thinking that there's going to be, and I'm happy to be wrong because I have been wrong. There are children, young people that can do that. But on the whole, generally speaking, most children, young people will be really struggling to make sense of all of this. So I think that's something to think about. I think we're more likely to see getting lost in gaming, I think, or living a much more online world. And, you know, on and of itself, I'm not sure that's necessarily an issue, as long as the safeguarding issues are concerns are in place. Where it becomes an issue is if you're seeing changes in the behaviour, or there are not enough other options going on, so that child is then completely and utterly engrossed in gaming. Certainly.
So it sounds like it's either withdrawal or it's like, in your face, it's kind of one of the two extremes that you're kind of looking out for.
Well, let's look at that through a stress response system lens for a moment. So if we're having, if our stress response system is activated, which is what happens automatically, because that's part of our mechanism for survival, then we have this inbuilt system that will go into fight, flight, or freeze. So if we bring that into the way of thinking, then yes, we are, those are the options available to us. We're more likely to see fight or flight. Freeze is a much more extreme response, but that I'm not going to go into that because that's much more complicated. But fight or flight, if we look at behavior from that lens, we can see it as a stress response rather than as poor behavior. And equally, when those children and young people are back in the classroom, they are going to be a mixed group of children and young people, some of whom are going to be continuously in their stress response activation. And that's going to be quite challenging, potentially, if it's not handled well within the school. And schools are such a spectrum. Some schools are completely compassionate and connected and understand that, you know, when our stress response system is activated, safety is the intervention. How do I help this child feel safe? More importantly, how do I make this classroom feel safe? How do I help the children be seen? How do I help them feel soothed? This is Dan Siegel's Seen, Safe, Soothed and Secure. How do I create my school, my classroom, my community, my house to have those kind of components? Because that's what's going to support a classroom that is even able to think about how to hold what is returning in September. But other schools, sorry, just to finish that point, there are other schools who are entirely focused on a narrative that will be around catching up, exams, totally focused on the education side of things rather than understanding that all children have had some sort of experience. And then, of course, you have all the different types of school in between across that broad spectrum.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting talking to my own children and my daughter in particular, who's 10, about kind of how she sees this going back to school, because she absolutely adores school. She just loves the institution of school, and she desperately, desperately missed it through the lockdown. And she just was wishing about it to go back to school. And I kept saying to her, you know, it's not going to be the same. You know, there are going to be changes, because I could see that she just thought a switch would be flicked and she would go from this existence in lockdown at home to back to school completely normal as she remembered it. And every time I brought this up, she got really distressed about how school was going to be different because she didn't understand what that difference actually looked like. And we were talking about it with my in-laws, and my father-in-law plays golf, and she was visibly getting distressed. And he actually then started talking about specifics about how playing golf was different in, you know, the kind of COVID safe kind of way. And silly examples like they're not allowed to touch the flags and they only play in threes rather than fours. And they've made the, I don't even know what the proper words are, but they're like the holes that the balls go into are much shallower. So they don't actually have to put their hand in the hole. They can just pick the ball up and their hands don't touch the edges of the holes. And once she understood that, she was like, oh, that's what you mean about it being different. It's basically the same, but with tweaks to it to make it safe. But I think that the reason I'm saying this is that I think all this talk of change is very unsettling. You know, children going back into school and not really knowing, you know, the whole school day being different from how it's been previously. You know, that is unsettling. They don't necessarily feel safe because it's not the same routine that they're used to. And I think the important thing is kind of getting them to understand how these changes make them safer. Does that make sense to you? The differences that they'll see in the school day are for safety. They're not for discomfort, but it's how you get them into that feeling of safety in this new regime. Does that make sense, Lisa?
Yeah, and I guess what I would say there is that safety is complicated. So we have the safety from, trying to not contract the virus. We have safety with doors and windows being locked, or whatever it is that we might have. We have that sense of safety that there might be a gate that no one can get into, so that the children have that physical safety. But then of course we have emotional safety. Mm-hmm. And how do we find emotional safety? Now, your example's beautiful because you're talking about your daughter and you're talking about her grandparents and her parents having a conversation with her very calmly, talking to her about things they've experienced. So she's got that relational resource around her. And that helped her feel emotionally safe enough to deal with the small challenges and the small changes that are for her health safety. So I think that's what I would really be asking parents to think about and their teachers to think about and the whole school culture to think about. Because if I don't feel emotionally safe, then depending on where I sit and what experiences I've had, you telling me to keep washing my hands, I can't even hear you. If I'm permanently in my stress response system, I just can't even get into that stuff with you. I need my system to feel safe. I need, where I've flipped my lid, as Dan Segal calls it with the hand model, I need to get that back down again so that my mind and my brain are all working together, all the areas are working together. So your example is a lovely example around emotional safety. So imagine then if you have children who do not have those relationships, mm-hmm. and not having those conversations and not having anyone explain to them those kind of things. And they're in the classroom everybody's in the classroom together. And they're then in a classroom where safety, emotional safety, has not been the most paramount issue, then that classroom is going to have lots of challenges. So, and I think some children, particularly children who do have those secure relationships out of the house, are more likely to respond to fearful messages. Like, if you don't do this, then this will happen. So the idea around consequences and sanctions. Children who don't have those experiences are generally not likely to respond to sanctions and consequences. Safety is the intervention, not going on a chart saying they did or they didn't wash their hands 15 times. Mm-hmm. So that's when we get into the real kind of the nub of different work that I do. And listen, there are some fantastic, amazing educators and school cultures and school environments. I go into them and they have worked their socks off. They didn't have an Easter holiday. They didn't have a half term. They didn't stop. They made sure that everyone in their community had food. They made sure that they had, they were doing what I call, from Bruce Perry's work, relational dosing. You know, that drip, drip feed of I'm thinking of you. You know, they were doing, singing happy birthday on Twitter. They were, you know, they were doing things to help foster that sense of belonging, dignity and safety. And when you do that, that creates a space that works for all children. All children.
Yes.
Yes.
I think the interesting thing, you know, I think most of the people who will be listening to this will have that secure family unit where, you know, when you, I describe my that conversation with my daughter, they will be able to sit down and listen. And, you know, that conversation happened after several conversations that I'd had with my daughter where, you know, I was trying to explain that it would be different, but there were no concrete examples and it just sent her off into a panic. And I was like, what am I doing? What am I doing wrong here? You know, what can I do better to help her get her head around this situation? But yeah, that conversation was a lucky conversation in many ways because we had the concrete examples and in the emotionally safe environment, and the two things worked together to make her feel calmer. But, you know, most of the families that are listening to this will have the potential to achieve that. When those students who are coming from those emotionally safe spaces go into a school environment with other students who are not coming from emotionally safe spaces and are exhibiting these fight or flight responses, what do the students do? Mm. How do they cope with their classmates effectively?
Yeah. I mean, certainly, I think teaching children about boundaries is really important. Because there are some behaviours that we, you know, are not acceptable to have around us, but we can still understand where they're coming from. So I think that's an important conversation. We can still be empathic about where those behaviours are coming from without necessarily having to endure some of the more extreme behaviours that perhaps we might see from older teens who are really struggling. And again, I would say, you know, there are always going to be some children for whom mainstream school is just too difficult to handle and just too hard, and who benefit actually from being in smaller, more specialist school environments. The challenge is, of course, that lots of children go without having any placements, which is also not a good situation, or we see a rise in exclusions, which is also not a good situation. So I would say we're looking at boundaries, we're looking at having conversations at home that help people understand what's going on. If parents want to understand the Dan Segal hand model of the brain, which I think all children should be taught what's going on with their brain, then literally just pop that into YouTube and the man himself will sit there and talk through it. Because that doesn't just help children understand themselves and start to think, okay, I can, what's going on? I can feel this is happening for me. But it also helps them understand other children. And I think it's safe to say that children are often more compassionate with each other than the adults are.
Yes.
You know, you're more likely to see adults in a Facebook group being less compassionate about something that's going on at school and other children. You're more likely to have teachers in the staff room, and I'm being a bit tongue-in-cheek, you know, talking about children in the classroom. Other children tend to be much more able to understand inequity. So for example, I've often been presented with this notion that, well, we have to treat them all the same. We have to treat them all the same, otherwise it's not fair. Okay, so my first thing there is, no, it's not fair. Life is not fair and it is not equal. And there are many inequities in education that we have. And actually, one child will understand that another child needs to have a snack at a different time because they have diabetes, in a way that an adult doesn't need to say, well, you can't have a snack at 10:10, we snack at 10:20. You know, that's adult stuff. Children generally understand that, you know, there are things that we might need that are different, you know, at different points.
Yeah, I always like to say, you know, the fair way to treat children is to treat them, each of them, as they as individuals need to be treated.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, if your child is in a classroom with another child that's really struggling, go into the school and say to them, do you have a relational policy? Because if they've got a policy that says one strike, two strikes, three strikes, you know, and it's very reward and sanction based.
Behaviour.
And very behaviourist in its approach. Then the children who are struggling, they're just going to struggle even more, which invariably impacts upon the children who aren't struggling. Mm-hmm. So rather than going into the school and complaining about that child, I'd be going into the school and saying, what are your inclusion policies? How do you ensure that the children who are really struggling feel safe? Because at the end of the day, this is your community. Mm-hmm. So the children who, let's just be really, really put this as a very blunt tool, okay? The children who are really struggling in your classroom, if there is a high level of exclusion in that school, they're more likely to be excluded. Groomers for sexual exploitation and criminalisation are more likely to hover around schools with high exclusions. Using the children in your communities to move drugs and sex around that community, and just as an example, and I know that I'm being a bit extreme because the trajectories are complicated. We know there's also a potential pipeline between exclusion and prison as well. So if this is your community and you have a classroom where you have those kind of children that are really struggling and that really don't have the relational resources around them, and that for whom school is going to be their only protective factor, then go into that school and ask them how they are being a protective factor for that school.
And I don't think that just comes to behaviour, does it? It comes to, you know, if a child's having mental health issues and they're just being told to kind of buckle up or buck up or whatever the phrase might be, you know, it's not necessarily going to go down those very dramatic criminal trajectories that you're talking about, but it may go down a very concerning mental health trajectory in a different way. And, you know, they need that security and safety and support to pull them back, you know, in whatever way they are struggling.
And that's why I say this is about all children. If we make it right for the children who find it the most difficult, all children benefit. Because in terms of young people and mental health, I mean, that is a space where we've had the most recent research actually came out of Bath University, which was a sort of emergency piece of research that literally was done at the beginning of COVID, was having a look at the potential outcomes around mental health for children and young people post-COVID. And they were not good. They were not good at all. And in fact, they were saying could last up to nine years. And there was plenty of research about poor mental health for young people, particularly prior to COVID. So that is definitely something that we all need to be thinking about. A life lived online is something that anyone born before 1998 does not understand what it is to have your whole life online 24 hours a day.
Lisa, could you tell us, well, really summarise for us the conversation that we've had today around trauma, adversity and attachment and the school closures and that kind of thing?
Okay, so I think what we've really talked about are relationships, resources and resilience. We've also talked about empathy, compassion and again relationships, and an understanding that these are our communities. Your community is your community, and if we can get things right for the most challenging, if you like, children in those spaces, and I don't like to call them challenging, but the children for whom have had the most challenges would be more accurate. If we can get things right for them, then we get things right for all children in our communities.
Yeah, that's really profound. Thank you, Lisa. So if people have been fascinated by what you've had to say today, where can they come and find out more about you or hear more of what you have to say?
Okay, so my website's lisacherry.co.uk. If you're interested particularly in adults looking back on the care experience, then my book, The Brightness of Stars, is a good place to go. I didn't mention through this podcast that I'm also care experienced and was excluded from every school I went to. So I think that's something to add into the conversation. People can find me on Twitter, where I spend far too much time, which is @_LisaCherry. And also, yeah, LinkedIn and Instagram.
And you have a podcast as well, don't you?
I have a podcast. It's called Trauma, Resonance, Resilience. And those conversations are, again, across all the sectors, but there's lots of conversations on there in the education sector.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Lisa. It's been a really, really insightful discussion today, and I really think it will help people as they transition back into schools. So thank you for your time today. I hope if you've been listening to today's episode, you found it really fascinating. Lisa clearly deals with a slightly different aspect of helping children to thrive in education from what I do. If you are looking for some more kind of academic focused tips on getting back into school, you can grab my back to school download from my website, and I will put the link in today's show notes, and that will help you with things like routines and priorities with going back into schools. So thank you so much for your time today. Have a wonderful day, and I hope to see you soon. Goodbye.